Chapter 41. Rose. April 1980. I couldn't get out of bed for 2 days. It was like I was having a breakdown. I wanted to block it all out. The image of the knife going into his side, the horror on his face, the blood that gushed out of him, the hole we dug in the garden. The smell of the wet soil, the worms that squirmed inside, the thud of his body as he landed in the makeshift grave. It seeped into my dreams, turning them to nightmares. My act, his death, had opened up a floodgate of all the old feelings and fears. Daphne was brilliant. She took care of you, taking you to play school, picking you up, cooking for you, washing your clothes, keeping you safe. She was the only other person in the whole world I trusted to do these things, apart from maybe Joyce and Roy next door. "Rose, darling," she said, sitting on the edge of my bed the next evening, "you need to eat something." It was dark and you were fast asleep, tucked up in bed. Daphne had brought you up earlier to say goodnight, and I had hugged you to me, as though your innocence could mend my dark, dark heart. And then I'd listened to your giggles from down the hall, as Daphne read you a story in your bedroom, taking ages to do all the funny voices. She had a cup of something in her hand. "Drink this. I've put some whiskey in it. You're in shock, that's all. You'll be as right as rain in a few days' time." As right as rain. That was such an un-Daphne thing to say. And I realised she was as out of her depth as I was. "I'm a murderer," I said, sitting up and taking the mug. "I've crossed a line, taken a life. I'm never going to get over this." I couldn't stop thinking of the mound of fresh earth near our patio slabs, the patch of brown in the grass that marked out his grave. How could I ever go into the garden again? Or look out of the kitchen window without that constant reminder? "You have to," she said, her voice stern. "You can't stay up here feeling sorry for yourself, Rose. You're a mother. That's the greatest gift. You've cleansed the world of one evil man. It's a shame we can't do the same with the others." She laughed then, to show she was joking. But something in her eyes made me think if I suddenly agreed, she would do it. 2 30-something vigilantes. "I haven't got the stomach for it," I said, trying to force a chuckle. She smoothed the hair back from my face tenderly. "I know you haven't. You're too sweet, too kind." She kissed my forehead. "Will you stay with me tonight?" I asked. "I don't want to be alone." "Of course." She climbed into bed with me, fully clothed, pulling the duvet over us both, propped up by pillows. I could feel her socked feet against my bare legs. I sipped my tea, the whiskey warm as it travelled down my throat. "Every time I close my eyes, I can see his face." "I know," she soothed. "I just want those images to go away." "They will." "Really?" I turned to assess her. "You seem to know a lot about it." I hesitated. I needed to ask her, but I was terrified of the answer. What would I do if Neil was right? I took her hand in mine, her bones fine underneath my fingers. You and she were the only two people I loved in the whole world. "Please just tell me the truth. I can't bear lies. No more lies. But I need to know. Was Neil right? Are you Jean Burden? She looked at me for the longest time, her pupils massive in the fading light, obscuring most of her iris. Just when I thought she wasn't going to answer, she said, "Would you still love me, Rose?" Would I? I had you to think about. Maybe if I hadn't just killed a man, I might have kicked her out there and then. I need to know the truth. Her eyes filled with tears. "I didn't mean to do it," she said, in such a small voice that I had to strain to hear her. "It was an accident. I was 10 years old. My childhood, it wasn't good, Rose. But I've never hurt anyone else. You need to believe me." I stared at her. She'd been a child. I couldn't imagine her hurting anyone now. I was the one who had killed Neil, after all. And I was so in love with her. I would have believed anything she told me. We sat up most of that night, talking. She opened up to me for the first time since we'd met. She told me the story of Jean Burden, the little girl the newspapers had dubbed evil, of how she was neglected and physically abused by her father, left to roam around the abandoned bomb sites of East London. "And then I made a friend," she said, her face ashen in the moonlight. "And I was so happy that I'd found someone who actually cared about me. I wasn't emotionally intelligent. I didn't understand about relationships, particularly with other kids. I had this rage inside me." She gave a little sob, and I squeezed her hand in reassurance. "Anyway, when Susan, that was her name, decided she didn't want to be friends with me anymore, I saw red. They said I picked up a brick and smacked her over the head with it. But I can't remember doing that. I think I might have pushed her, though, and she fell and hit her head. Oh, Daphne. I went to prison, of course. Well, it wasn't an adult prison. A secure unit. I was rehabilitated, thankfully, by well-adjusted, kind adults who taught me the rights and wrongs my own parents never did." She pulled the quilt up to her chin and shivered as though remembering. "It must have been awful," I said. "It was less awful than the house I was brought up in. I couldn't even imagine. My own upbringing had been lovely. The only child to two kind, attentive parents." I let Daphne talk that night about her childhood, her life, how she was given a new identity as Sheila Watts, how she'd had to steal the identity of Daphne Hartle from her friend Alan when she realised that the journalist, Neil Lewisham, had discovered who she really was. I didn't tell her my story, not then. I'd kept it a secret for so many years that to speak it out loud would have felt too much. And I didn't want things to change between us. Daphne might feel uncomfortable if she knew my history. I continued to let her believe I was a widow, that my husband had died before you were born. I hadn't even told her about my last girlfriend. Audrey and I were together a long time. We didn't hide our sexuality. There was nobody to hide it from. My parents were dead, and she came from a very liberal, cerebral family. Her parents were academics. Even in the 1970s, with free love and the sexual revolution, there were still those who judged us, who thought nothing of telling us of their disapproval. But when I turned 30... I wanted the one thing Audrey couldn't give me. A baby. And that was when I met Victor. Chapter 42. Lorna. We need to ring DS Barnes, says Lorna, first thing the next morning. Should we disturb them on a Sunday? Asks Safi from the sofa, wrapped in her velour dressing gown the colour of aubergines, looking a little peaky. Tom is still in bed. They were up late last night, talking for hours after Theo and Jen had left. Lorna was wide awake at 7 a.m. and has already been on the phone to her boss back in Spain to tell him she'll need more time off. He was surprisingly understanding. Absolutely, this is important, she replies firmly. Although it's still early, the sun is already streaming through the windows, and it cheers Lorna up. She needs it after last night's revelations. The only good thing to come out of it is that she might have a half-brother. But the rest, Victor Carmichael being her dad, and the despicable things he might have done. What kind of man would send a thug like Glenn Davies to frighten her? His own daughter? The murdering kind, she thinks. Could he have something to do with the bodies in the garden? Is he now panicking because the past is catching up with him and worried he'll be found out all these years later? What evidence does her mother have against him? And then there's Safi. She glances at her daughter, who is staring into the middle distance, biting at her thumbnail. All the resentment Safi has been harbouring, things Lorna wasn't even aware of. Has she been a bad mother? Her daughter's words still feel like a wound to her heart. She doesn't know how to make any of it better. Lorna picks up her mobile from the coffee table. Would you mind putting the kettle on, honey? And I'll phone DS Barnes. She's already had 2 cups of coffee this morning and feels jittery. Safi comes too reluctantly, gets off the sofa and heads into the kitchen. She can hear her clattering about, opening cupboards and plonking mugs onto the worktop. DS Barnes answers straight away. She launches into an account of last night's events, talking so fast he has to ask her to repeat herself.
Wow, good work,
he says when she's finished.
We'll send someone to talk to Victor Carmichael today.
He lives in Yorkshire.
That's not a problem. And now we know who Glenn Davies works for, it shouldn't be hard to find him either,
he says. Lorna feels a wave of relief. She's been on constant alert since he grabbed her off the street. She hopes they can lock him up.
As you can guess,
he adds,
the card he gave you wasn't legitimate. The number is probably a burner phone, and it rang out when one of my officers called. We can organise a DNA test. When is Theo returning home?
He's staying until tomorrow. I've got his number. I'm sure he won't mind me giving it to you.
Great. I'll keep you updated.
He ends the call, and Lorna joins Safi in the kitchen. She's staring into the fridge.
We've run out of milk. Again. How are we getting through so much?
She wails.
I'm sorry, says Lorna, remembering. I used the rest of it for my coffee this morning. Why don't you go back to bed? I'll pop to the village and get some more.
She rubs her daughter's arm, the velour soft like a teddy bear under her fingers.
I'll make something nice for dinner tonight, something nutritious.
Thanks, Mum. Would you mind taking Snowy with you? Lorna agrees and watches as Safi pads down the hall and up the stairs, like she's got the weight of the world on her shoulders. Lorna is coming out of the corner shop, clutching a plastic bag, when she bumps into Melissa.
Lovely to see you again, she says, smiling brightly at Lorna.
She has a pair of reading glasses on a chain around her neck. Lorna wonders what it must be like,
living in the same village for all of your life. She's not even been here 2 weeks, and she's already starting to feel oppressed.
After meeting you the other day, I've been thinking a lot.
Melissa lowers her voice as she leans on her stick. About Rose and Daphne.
Oh, yes?
Lorna tries not to get her hopes up. It was nearly 40 years ago. What could Melissa remember that would be useful?
Would you like to come for a cup of tea? My cottage is only down there, by the river.
Beside the market cross, she can hear a toddler crying and a woman's voice coaxing.
That would be lovely, she says.
She senses that Melissa is probably lonely and wants a trip down memory lane. It will give Safi and Tom some time to themselves, and she'd like to know more about what her mother was like when she was younger, as well as the mysterious Daphne. She needs a distraction until she meets up with Theo and Jen later.
Do you mind dogs? She asks, untying Snowy's lead from the lamppost. He's my daughter's.
Of course not.
Melissa hitches her carpet bag over her shoulder. She walks slowly, resting heavily on her stick. They cross the little bridge and follow the river for a bit, Snowy stopping to sniff the trunk of a weeping willow. Until they get to a row of cottages at the opposite end of the village to Safi's house. Melissa's cottage is smaller, terraced, but with the same Cotswold stone and all of the character that Lorna has come to expect from properties in Beggar's Nook. She follows Melissa through the door and straight into a sitting room with low-beamed ceilings. It's old-fashioned, with big-armed floral sofas and plates on the wall. But it has charm, and it's clean and tidy, which is important to Lorna. She can't abide mess. She wonders if Melissa ever married or had children of her own.
Make yourself at home, she says, indicating the sofa. Cup of tea?
Lorna says that would be lovely and offers to make it, but Melissa is having none of it. She's fiercely independent and, obviously feeling more secure in her own cottage, props her walking stick against the wall. Lorna settles herself on the sofa, with Snowy by her feet. Melissa returns with two mugs and hands one to Lorna, then sinks her large frame into a faded armchair opposite, by the little leaded window.
Gorgeous fireplace, says Lorna.
It's wrought iron, with a guard around the outside. The mantelpiece is cluttered with figurines and photo frames. She can't help wondering how long it would take to dust it all. But it's spotless. Not a dust mote in sight.
Thank you. We have them in all the rooms. Although, I never used the bedroom ones. I doubt anybody does these days. But the cottages were built before central heating. She chuckles.
Gives character, though, says Lorna, sipping her tea and thinking of the fireplaces in Safi's cottage. She wonders if the ones in the bedrooms have been used since her mother lived there.
Anyway, so tell me, what were you about to say outside the shop?
Melissa sets her mug on the side table next to her and purses her lips. Her chin's wobbling.
Well, she says, seeing you and reminiscing about Rose brought it all back.
Brought it all back?
That strange autumn.
Lorna shrugs off her jacket. It's a warm day, but Melissa has her heating on and the room is stifling. Her lower back is starting to feel sweaty.
The autumn of 1980?
Yes.
In what way was it strange?
Well, she folds her arms across her stomach. That's when I started to notice something wasn't quite right with Rose.
Really?
Lorna leans forward to place her cup down. The tea is making her feel hotter.
Like I said before, she was always quiet, kept herself to herself. It was obvious she was a devoted single mother. She never mentioned a husband. She always seemed jittery and on edge, overly worried about your safety. Anyway, I'm repeating myself. I've told you that before. But although Rose did all of those things, she still tried to help out in the community. She volunteered at the church cafe twice a month. She was in the WI. And then, around early summer, she stopped. She cut herself off completely from all of us in the village.
And what about Daphne?
Oh, we still saw Daphne about. She worked for a bit at the pub, and then at the local farm. Occasionally, we saw the three of you together, so we knew Rose was okay. I think she felt she needed nobody but Daphne. They were so self-contained.
And you thought they might have been in a relationship?
I think so, yes. Although they didn't advertise it. Different times.
So what did you mean about that strange autumn?
Well, it was the weirdest thing. But Rose came to me. I remember it was bonfire night. There was an event in the village, up at the farm, fireworks and the like. I'd seen her there with Daphne and you. Rose seemed even more on edge, but I wondered if it was because it was a big event. I don't think she liked crowds. Perhaps she didn't feel safe. Anyway, later, much later, she cornered me and told me she was scared for her life.
Oh my God, gasps Lorna. She hadn't been expecting that. Did she say why?
It was after I told her that someone had come into the cafe looking for her. She asked who, but I didn't know the man's name. At that time, I'd never seen him before. But I did see him a few times after Rose moved away, just around the village. But then he must have left too, because I never saw him again. Anyway, she said she had done something and she was scared they'd take you away from her. She was in a bit of a state, to be honest. It was all really strange. I tried to calm her down, but she was so cagey, so worried about telling me anything.
Was it Victor she was so scared of? Lorna picks at one of her gel nails. Had he found her? And that was why she'd left in such a hurry, without saying goodbye to anyone. Did the man give his name? Melissa shakes her head.
No, not that I can recall.
And did my mum mention the name Victor to you? Melissa frowns.
I don't know. Maybe. It was all such a long time ago. I just remember her being really scared after I told her someone was looking for her. Why? Who is Victor?
I think he's my father, and she was running away from him.
Oh, that's awful. It makes sense now. She seemed very scared that night. Like I said before, we just assumed she was a widow when she first arrived in the village.
Lorna shuffles in her seat. It can't be a coincidence, can it? She finds out someone is looking for her and then runs away. She sighs. I don't remember much about living here, or Daphne, she says. So they must have parted ways at some point when I was still young. Me and my mum, we lived in Bristol after moving away from here.
They seemed so close.
As much as I love her, my mother is a funny one. In all the years I can remember, she never had a relationship with a man or a woman. She concentrated on me and then, when I left home, on my daughter.
Something really seemed to scare her on bonfire night, though, says Melissa wistfully. She said.
She looks towards her fireplace and frowns.
Something really odd.
What did she say?
She said, if anything bad happens to me, look in the fireplace.
Lorna frowns.
The fireplace? Which one? Yours?
She laughs. No, I don't think mine. I assumed hers. But I don't know.
Lorna's heart starts to race. The fireplace. She must be talking about the evidence that Victor has been so desperate to find. Is that where it's been all this time? And she can barely contain her excitement. Did you ever look?
No. No, I didn't think much about it, really. After she left, I'd heard that she still owned the house and was renting it out. So it's not like anything bad had happened to her. If it had, if, I don't know, she'd been found dead in the house or anything like that, well then yes, yes, I would have done as she asked. But she left. Other people moved in. About 10 years after she left, around 1990, I bumped into an estate agent who was looking at the house and asked him about Rose. He said she still owned it, that she rented Skelton Place out. I assumed she'd outrun the man she was so frightened of.
God, thinks Lorna, tears blinding her vision when she thinks of her mother, alone and scared, bringing her up by herself.
The body's in the garden, says Melissa suddenly. Do they know who they are yet?
One was a journalist called Neil Lewisham, and the other, they still don't know. But I've been wondering. Maybe they didn't split up and the other body is Daphne's.
Melissa breathes in sharply. But who would have killed her?
Lorna looks down at her hands. I'm worried the police will think it's my mum.
No, no, that's not right, Melissa says emphatically. Rose would never have hurt Daphne or let anyone else hurt her. Not without calling the police or doing something.
Unless it wasn't my mother who killed her, says Lorna, swallowing. Chapter 43. Safi. What are you doing? Asks Tom, as I get out of bed and start to dress hastily.
I thought we could have a lie-in. He raises his eyebrows suggestively. What with Lorna out for a bit?
I'm sorry, I want to go and see Gran. I just feel I need to see her, to spend time with her.
We're meeting up with Theo and his wife later, remember? Will you be back in time?
Yes.
I throw on a t-shirt I haven't worn for about 2 years, some jogging bottoms, and scrunch my hair into a messy bun.
Tom sits up. He's bare-chested, and I feel a flicker of desire. But just as quickly, it's gone. My mind is too full of other things.
I'll come with you. I haven't seen your gran for ages, and...
No!
I bark, then realise I sound a bit harsh.
No, I say, more softly. It's okay. I think Gran might talk more if it's just me.
He stares at me, concern etched on his face.
I'm worried about you, Saf. This is all a lot to take in, and now you're going to hair off to Bristol.
I won't be long.
I sit on the edge of the bed, pushing my feet into trainer socks. I want to ask Gran about Victor, now that I know more. And it might be easier without...
Without your mum there?
I nod guiltily. He takes my hand.
Is everything okay between the two of you? I noticed some tension yesterday when I got back. I know you'd just had an intense meet-up with Theo and found out about Victor, but there was something else, like something brewing between you.
We had a bit of an argument. I said some things I shouldn't have said.
Oh, Saf.
I know, it's not my proudest moment. Mum tries her best, and I do love her, but...
Hey. He holds up his hands. You don't have to explain it to me. I know it's complicated between the two of you.
My gran was just so much less complicated, you know? Or...
I laugh ironically. So I thought.
He pulls me towards him and kisses me. "Drive carefully," he says. "And don't be too long, or your mum might have reorganized the whole house."
When I arrive, Gran is in bed. Joy tells me she's had a bad night, and I try to quell the swirls of anxiety in the pit of my stomach as I head down the corridor to her room. Millie, Gran's lovely nurse, warned me that one day she may not recognize me at all, that the little pockets of lucid moments will be rarer until they're non-existent. We've been lucky up until now, I know. One day, she will be gone completely. And in her place will be an old lady who doesn't remember who she is, let alone who I am. An old lady with no memories, past or present. She's sitting up in bed, propped up by two massive pillows, the blankets tucked underneath her armpits. Her hands, folded across the covers, look bony and frail, her skin like rice paper, crisscrossed with blue veins. Her eyes are closed, and I stand at the door and watch her for a while. Her translucent eyelids, her lashes, once long and dark but now sparse, dusting her weathered pink cheeks. She looks a lot older than her 76 years, a shrunken figure in the large bed. On her table is a framed photograph of me when I was a teenager, taken in the garden of her Bristol house underneath the apple tree, hugging her black Labrador, Bruce. I haven't been in her room since she moved in last year, and the sight of the photo brings a lump to my throat, and I have to concentrate on not crying. I don't want Gran to see me upset. Quietly, so as not to wake her, I sit in the chair next to her bed. Opposite is a large window, and I can see a tree in blossom outside, the pink petals obscuring half of the glass. She'll like that, I think, as I take one of her frail hands. I wish I could go back to a time when she wasn't suffering from dementia. All those years when I sat in her living room, just the two of us. All those missed opportunities to talk. For me to find out about her past. There is a tray over her bed, as if she's in a hospital, containing a jug of water and a glass. I pour some for her, just in case she'd like it when she wakes up. And then I sit with her, enjoying it being just the two of us, as it used to be. I'm on my phone, reading the work emails I'd missed during the week, when I hear a cough. I look up to see that Gran has woken up. She lies there just staring straight ahead for a few moments, as though trying to get her bearings, until she notices me. And then her eyes widen.
"Who are you?"
she whispers, her voice croaky. I hand her the glass of water, and she puts it to her lips, her hand trembling. "It's me, Gran. It's Safi." I point to the photo. "Your granddaughter, remember?" But there is just confusion in her eyes. Confusion and fear. So I start to talk about Skelton Place, about Snowy, about Mum, the house in Bristol with the pebble dash and the greenhouse, anything to help her remember who she is. "And you used to show me your tomato plants in the greenhouse, remember? You taught me how to plant seeds and radishes." I have to stop to swallow my emotions. "And now I'm going to have a baby of my own."
"A baby?"
She smiles, and it lights her whole face. And she's my gran again.
my wonderful, kind, quiet-mannered gran, who loved knitting and gardening and watching daytime TV and dunking custard creams in her overstewed tea. I lean forward to take her hand. "You'll be a great grandmother. Imagine that," I say, trying to keep my voice light.
"Imagine that,"
she repeats, her eyes glistening. She hasn't got her teeth in, and it makes her look so much older, the bottom half of her face like a Punch and Judy puppet. And then her eyes cloud.
"You'll be a good mother, won't you? You'll look after the baby."
"Of course I will. And Tom will make a good father."
"Tom. Tom," she says.
Then recognition flashes across her face.
"Tom is a good man."
"He is."
"You're very lucky. Neil wasn't a good man. And neither was Victor."
"Victor?" I'm relieved she's brought him up. This is my chance. "Is Victor your ex-husband, Gran?" I ask. She lets out a snort of laughter.
"Of course not. I've never been married."
"But Victor is Lorna's dad. Lolly's dad." Her big hazel eyes meet mine.
"Yes. Yes, I think he is."
"You think?" Her face crumples.
"Everything is so foggy. My memories, they aren't always clear."
"I know," I say gently. "I know, Gran." Her eyes fill with tears, and mine immediately follow suit. "It's okay," I say. "It's okay."
"It's not,"
she says, as a tear falls from her eyes and snakes down her crinkly cheek.
"Even after all these years, I miss her. My heart aches."
"Miss who, Gran?"
"I miss her."
I wonder if she's talking about Daphne. "What happened to her?" I ask, although I'm not sure I want the answer. What if she confesses to me right now that she killed her and buried her in the garden alongside Neil? What would I do with that information? She's an old woman now, and I love her. I want to protect her. What good could come out of a confession? For the first time since all this began, I'm not sure I want to get to the truth. Maybe secrets really are best buried. "Did Victor hurt her, Gran?" She nods, tears on her cheeks.
"Yes, he did. He's not a nice man."
"I know," I say. "He doesn't sound it."
"He tricked her,"
she says now.
"Tricked Daphne?"
She shakes her head. "No, no." "He tricked you?" She looks at me and blinks. Then she reaches out and cups my hair behind my ears.
"I love you," she says.
"Oh, Gran, I love you too.
And I love Lolly. Don't let Victor find her,"
she says, closing her eyes again.
"Keep her safe."
"Gran, Victor is an old man now. He won't hurt her." When she opens her eyes, I can tell that the Gran I know has gone, replaced by a stranger.
"Who are you?"
she says, as though the conversation we've just had has never taken place. So I sit patiently and repeat everything I said earlier, hoping she'll come back to me. As I'm walking to my car later, I receive a phone call from DS Barnes. They've found Glenn Davies. He's been arrested. Chapter 44. Rose. Summer, 1980. It was getting worse, my fear and paranoia. Every time there was a noise, I'd think it was the police at the door coming to arrest me. Every time I walked into the village, I worried people were talking about me, that they somehow knew. An article had appeared in the newspaper about Neil Lewisham's disappearance, and when I saw his face staring out from the pages, I had to walk out of the shop, panic engulfing me. I wasn't coping well, mentally, with the fact I had killed a man. Even if I tried to convince myself I had done it for good reason. Daphne was amazing. Over the next few months, she became my rock. She had some paving slabs delivered from a local stonemason and told me she was going to make over the garden. But I knew what she was really doing. She was lengthening the patio so that it covered the area where Neil's body was buried, so that I no longer had to look at the patch in the grass that didn't match the rest of the lawn. "Where did you learn how to do all this stuff?" I asked one day, when she came into the kitchen after laying the slabs, a smudge of dirt on her cheek. She glanced around to make sure you weren't in earshot. "I learnt a lot in prison," she said, her cheeks reddening, and she looked vulnerable then. "I was there for a long time." "Oh, Daphne." I tried to remain strong, for her and for you. But the nightmares continued, and I would wake up during the night covered in a film of sweat. Neil's face morphed into Victor's, and I was convinced he would find us. After all, Neil had. I still hadn't told Daphne about Victor, but the deeper in love we fell, the harder it was not to talk about my past. Not that she ever asked or pushed. She didn't talk about her time as Jean either. It was as though we both just wanted to live in the here and now. As though we didn't exist before we found each other. "You must stop torturing yourself over Neil," said Daphne, on the many occasions when I had gone to her, shaking and crying, guilt and fear taking me over. She'd pull me into her arms and kiss me and reassure me that it would all be okay. "Nobody will ever know," she said. But that just made me feel worse, out of control and vulnerable. It puzzled me how Daphne didn't seem to worry about Neil and the fact his rotten remains were buried in our garden. His disappearance had made the papers, after all. He had been married with a young son. The guilt of that ate away at me. Even with the new paving slabs, I hated going out there, and every time I did, the memories of that night flooded back. It was hard, especially during that hot summer, as you wanted to be in the garden all the time. "I'll go with her," Daphne would say, touching my arm gently. And I'd watch, like a prisoner, from the kitchen window, as she sat with you as you dug your little spade into the soil and made a small rockery, trying not to wince that the body of the man I had killed lay less than 20 feet away. At night, I dream of going downstairs and seeing the paving slabs taken up to reveal the hole in the ground, empty, his body gone. Other times I worried that we hadn't dug deep enough and something, a neighbouring dog or fox, might accidentally dig it up, exposing the corpse. Or that he was still alive. He'd survived the stabbing and was intent on revenge, still wearing his blood-stained T-shirt. "No animal can dig it up now I've laid the slabs. Don't worry," Daphne would reassure me when I confided in her. Most nights she crept into my room after you were fast asleep. It was comforting to have her warm body next to mine. I didn't feel so alone with my dark thoughts. One hot, sticky night in July, as we lay in each other's arms with just a white sheet covering us, she said, "Do you think you're bisexual?" I sat up, leaning on my elbow to look at her, the moonlight highlighting her sharp cheekbones. "Why do you ask?" "Well, you were married." Actually, I've never been married." Her eyes looked huge in the half light. "What? But Lolly's father... I'm not a widow. I ran away from him. He was... is... a psycho." I felt her stiffen beside me. "I did wonder if you were running from someone too. You always seemed so cagey, like me, I suppose. Although we were both running from very different situations by the sound of it." She reached out and touched my cheek. "But then I thought maybe you were just shy." She took her hand away and pulled the sheet up over her chest. "Her arms were tanned after so many days in the garden with you. So are you still out there, Lolly's dad?" I nodded. "His name's Victor." "Victor." She sounded the name slowly. "That sounds posh." "We were never in a relationship, romantically," I said, to try to put her mind at rest. It's complicated." I didn't want to tell her about Victor and what he'd done to me. I didn't want it to sit between us like an evil presence tainting what we had. Before him, I was with a woman for a long time. Audrey. What about you? She chuckled in the darkness. I've had sex with men, but it never felt right. Then I realized I preferred women. I felt a throb of jealousy. We shouldn't put labels on it anyway. I'm not. I was just wondering about Lolly's father, that's all. I've always wanted children, but I'm 40 now. This surprised me. She looked younger. Really? You don't look it. She smiled in response. I nestled back down on the bed so that we were both under the sheet, facing each other. Shadows danced on the walls behind her. "Does it ever go away?" I whispered into the darkness. "Does what?" "The guilt. For taking someone else's life." She didn't say anything at first, and I wondered if I'd offended her. Then she said, her voice sad, "I'll never forgive myself for what I did to Susan. I've paid the price. I did my time. I ruined my life. But I'll never get over it. You were just a child. What's my excuse?" "Love," she said softly, finding my hand under the sheet. "You did it for love." Chapter 45. Lorna. Safi stares at her mother with her mouth hanging open. "In the fireplace? Which one? We've got four in this house." "I've already looked in that one," says Lorna sheepishly, indicating the fireplace in the living room, then showing Safi her dirty palms. "We use that one regularly when we first moved in," says Safi, her lips twitching. "Anything left there would have been incinerated a long time ago." Tom ambles into the room and hands them both a mug of tea. Lorna's drunk so much her mouth feels furred, but she accepts it anyway. Safi takes hers from Tom, and then he joins her on the sofa. Safi's looked sad since she came home from seeing her gran. She said she's getting worse, and Lorna feels a tug of guilt that she didn't accompany her today. She knows she needs to return to Spain soon. Her boss won't keep her job open forever, not to mention her apartment and the unfinished business with Alberto. On the other hand, she doesn't want to leave Safi and her mum. Her daughter's words still sting when she thinks about them. She'd hate Safi to think she was abandoning her. Safi jumps up.
Let's check upstairs, she says.
We can't be long, says Tom. Didn't you say we were meeting Theo at 2?
We've got half an hour, says Safi. It's important. Come on.
Lorna is about to get up from the chair, but then hesitates.
What will this evidence be? A murder weapon? A knife?
Safi puts her hands on her hips. Lorna can now see the clear outline of a bump.
Don't be silly, Mum. He said some kind of paperwork. That's what we're looking for.
Tom frowns but stands up too.
Why would Victor be so desperate to retrieve old paperwork? What could it possibly say that would tie him to a murder scene?
Well, let's find out, says Safi impatiently.
She grabs Tom's hand.
Come on.
Lorna follows Safi and Tom up the stairs, Snowy at their heels, barking excitedly, picking up on their adrenaline. They go into Safi and Tom's room first. The bed is unmade, and Tom's clothes from yesterday are thrown over the chair by the window. Safi goes to the small, wrought-iron fireplace.
I'll do it, says Tom, rushing forwards. I don't want you straining yourself.
Safi and Lorna watch as he stands on tiptoe and feels around inside the chimney breast. Safi shrieks and jumps backwards when he dislodges an angry-looking spider.
Nothing here, he says, shaking dust and cobwebs out of his hair.
Let's try yours next, says Safi.
God, Mum, she adds, when they walk into Lorna's immaculate bedroom.
You can make a mess, you know.
It's a smaller fireplace than the one in Safi's room and has a wooden surround carved with flowers. It doesn't take long to work out that there is nothing there, either.
The little bedroom, begins Lorna, but Safi's already off down the landing.
The little bedroom is empty, save for the boxes in the corner. Lorna can see where Tom's made a start on removing the wallpaper.
It's funny that this was my room.
She goes to the window and looks out onto the garden. She tries to imagine her mother there, with Daphne, digging away, burying a body. But she can't. It's like imagining Snowy with a human head.
Doesn't look like there's anything here either, says Safi.
Lorna turns to see her daughter feeling around the hearth, and above her, Tom reaching up into the chimney breast. They look like they're performing some comedy act.
Do you think Davy's found it?
Lorna sighs.
Maybe Melissa remembered it wrong. It was a long time ago.
Safi comes and stands next to her, and Lorna snakes an arm around her shoulders, even though she has to reach up to do so. They stand like that for a while, in the room that used to be Lorna's, staring at the fireplace, as though it has all the answers. They are just about to leave the house to meet Theo and Jen when Safi's phone rings. She reaches into her bag and answers it, mouthing that it's D.S. Barnes. Lorna's stomach turns over. What does he want now? Have they spoken to Victor?
Okay,
Safi is saying, throwing them both a worried look.
I see. And you're sure?
Right. She pushes a curl behind her ear.
Yes, that's fine. Thanks.
She presses the end call button on her phone and places it back in her bag.
What is it? Asks Tom.
Forensics checked the other body against the dental records they have for Jean Burden from when she was in prison, and the results have just come in. It isn't a match. It's not her. Chapter 46. Rose. September 1980. The trouble with love is that it blinds you. And I was so blinded by my feelings for Daphne that I felt like I have vertigo. I broke my one rule since fleeing Victor, to keep myself to myself. But one thing nagged away at me. Daphne knew too much about me. And I, in turn, knew too much about her. Her stolen identity, her infamy as Jean Burden, her incarceration. I knew I loved her, but would our crimes bind us together, make it hard for us to part in case one of us told on the other? What would happen to her if her true identity ever became public knowledge? She'd be vilified by vigilantes. Her new identity after leaving prison had been Sheila Watts, but she'd shed that skin the day she drowned herself. So now there were no probation officers keeping tabs, no officials making sure she didn't kill again. Not that I thought she would. I trusted her. After all, we were both killers now. And she had been an innocent, a child, neglected, abused, lashing out. I should have known better at the age of 36. No, if anything, Daphne had a hold over me. She could literally direct the police straight to the body. But I assured myself that it was worth it, because our love was the real thing. It was raw and true and forever. That it would never come to the stage when either of us had to use our knowledge as a kind of emotional blackmail to make the other stay. Daphne wasn't manipulative. She didn't play games. I didn't have to worry. Daphne wasn't like Victor. At least, that was what I told myself then. It was a beautiful morning in early autumn when the trees were just beginning to shed their leaves. You loved kicking through them on your way to play school. The village looked so pretty, surrounded by red, gold, and brown. It was brisk outside, but sunny. And after I dropped you off, I decided to walk the longer way home through the woods. It was peaceful, the sun slanting through the trees. And as I dug my hands into the pockets of my sheepskin coat, I felt awash with happiness. As I rounded the corner on the path that led to the back of the cottage, I noticed someone standing in our garden, by the stone wall that separated it from the woods. I stopped, hiding behind a thick tree trunk. It was Daphne. And she wasn't alone. She was with a man. My heart fluttered, my stomach turning over. Who was it this time? Not another journalist intent on finding out Daphne's true identity. I wondered if it was Sean, one of the farmhands. I'd never met him, but Daphne had become quite pally with him at work, by all accounts. It sounded like he gave her things. Spare eggs, the old tin of paint, a pint of milk. I hoped he wasn't taking these things illegally, but Daphne said he was all right, which, from her, was quite high praise. It did cross my mind that he might fancy her. But I trusted her. I knew she loved me. But as I peered closer, I could see it was Joel. Their voices floated towards me on the breeze. "I think you should go," I heard Daphne say. I went to step out from behind the tree. Was he bothering her again?
but his reply rooted me to the spot.
I don't understand why you've made up these lies about me, he said,
throwing his arms out in exasperation. I could see, even from my position, that he looked genuinely confused.
Rose and I were friends, and now she hasn't spoken to me in months. If I see her in the street, she avoids me.
That's her prerogative.
You turned her against me by making out that I'm some lech.
Don't be ridiculous.
I never came on to you. I never harassed you. The only thing I did was tell you how I felt about Rose. Is that why you did it? To stop us getting together?
Get it into your thick head. She's not interested and never will be. Whatever I might have told her, she hissed.
The anger on her face surprised me. She was usually so serene, so carefree. I'd always admired her patience, her kindness. I mean, of course she wasn't a saint. She was a warrior, like me. She got angry about injustices and inequality. She was independent and capable, but she was never petty or unfair. Or so I'd always thought. But if Joel was telling the truth, if she had lied about the advances he'd made on her, then that was a very manipulative thing to do.
But you didn't know that, did you? Not then. You thought she might like me too, and decided to put a stop to it. You might have fooled everyone else around here, Daphne, with your butter-wouldn't-melt facade, but I can see through you.
Why don't you just fuck off? She snarled. Leave us alone.
I inhaled so sharply my chest hurt. I waited for Joel's reaction, but he just shook his head sadly.
I hope you're not using her. She's a good person.
Of course I'm not.
He looked towards the cottage.
You've got a good setup there. A roof over your head. Love. A ready-made family.
She folded her arms across her chest. She was wearing a baggy fawn-coloured jumper and cream jumpers I bought her for her birthday. Her hair was starting to grow out and was now at her shoulders, but she kept it dark. I liked it that way. Her cheeks were red from the cold, and her eyes burnt with intensity. She looked beautiful.
I love Rose.
I hope you do.
You sound jealous.
Perhaps I am.
She toed the ground with my wellies, which she wore to work.
Well, she would never have been interested in you, no matter what I said.
He sighed.
But at least we would still have been friends.
Or do you not want that either?
I don't know what you mean. Does Rose see anybody apart from you?
She's always been reclusive. That's not my fault.
He shook his head.
Melissa told me Rose hardly ever does the bell ringing at the church anymore, or the WI.
That's her decision, not mine. We just want to spend all our time together.
Can't you remember what it's like? That first flush of love when all you want is each other.
Stop trying to make out it's something else.
I'd never stop Rose doing anything she wanted to do, and vice versa. I couldn't stand by and listen to any more of this. It didn't feel right. I stepped out of the shadow of the tree and made my way to the back of the garden. I climbed over the wall and jumped down onto the grass. The shock on Daphne's face was so comical, I had to suppress a laugh.
What are you doing?
She gasped as I walked over to where they stood.
Sorry, I sometimes come back this way. I like walking alone in the woods. I thought you were supposed to be at work.
Her face coloured a deep crimson.
Yes, I'm just going.
Joel popped over. I could tell she was trying to work out if I'd heard their conversation. But I kept things light.
Is everything okay?
I asked Joel.
It's all good.
He flashed me a warm smile.
Glad to see you're looking well, Rose. If you ever need anything.
He threw me a meaningful look.
Anything at all, you know where to find me, right?
Sure.
Good, then I'll be off.
We stood and watched as he strode across the lawn, disappearing around the side of the cottage.
What was all that about?
I said, wondering if Daphne would tell me the truth. But she reached up and kissed me deeply in response, pulling me against her.
I've got half an hour before I need to be in work. Let's make the most of Lolly not being here, she replied,
as she pulled away, taking my hand and leading me back towards the cottage. But I couldn't shake the feeling that settled inside me. If Daphne had lied and manipulated me over Joel, what else hadn't she been honest about?
Chapter 47, Theo. On Monday before his shift, Theo decides to visit his dad. He needs some answers now he knows about Lorna and Rose. He hasn't seen him since his dad stormed out of his restaurant last week. He waits a few minutes, annoyed with himself that his heart is beating faster than normal. And then he hears the thud of footsteps coming down the hall and the door is thrust open. His dad stands there in a pastel diamond pattern golfing jumper and chinos. What do you want? You need to let me in. I don't want to speak to you. Was it you who sent the police over? I might have guessed. Always so suspicious. He's about to shut the door in Theo's face, but Theo sticks his foot in the crack before he has a chance. Actually, it wasn't me. And if you let me in, then I can explain, says Theo, trying to sound more forceful than he actually feels. His dad stares pointedly at Theo's trainer wedged in the door. Doesn't look like I have a choice, he says, stepping backwards. He then turns on his heel and walks stiffly down the hall. Theo follows him into the kitchen. It's immaculate as always. Not one thing out of place. His dad stands at the counter in the corner and switches the kettle on. Be quick. I'm due at the club. Theo wonders, in that moment, if his dad has the capacity to love. He can't imagine ever talking to his own child in the way his father speaks to him. What did the police say? Nothing much. Just ask me a few questions. What about? He doesn't say anything. Just stands there blinking at Theo. I know about Rose Grey. I know that she has a daughter who is possibly my sister. He continues to stare at Theo coldly. I know that you have that thug, Davis, threatening the family. Threatening your own daughter, for fuck's sake. What is wrong with you? His dad looks taken aback. Theo has never sworn at his father before, and the good boy inside him, the kid that always aims to please, flinches as he says it. I don't know what you're talking about. You're so like your mother, letting your emotions run away with you. At least I have some, unlike you. I loved your mother, and I loved Rose, he replies. Theo wants to laugh. He's sure his dad doesn't know what love is. He's confusing possession with love. So, who was Rose to you? She was someone I once had a relationship with. His dad's eyes flicker, and Theo gets the impression he's not telling the truth. And what happened? She was living with me and left when she was pregnant. I tried to find her, but it wasn't so easy back then. No mobile phones, no tracking, no internet. She just disappeared off the face of the earth. And then I met your mother, and Rose seemed less important. And your daughter? I wasn't even sure if Rose had had the baby. She was around your age when I met her. She'd been around. She was only 6 months pregnant when she left me. And she was so flighty. This doesn't tie up with what Lorna said about her mother. Are you saying that you didn't think the baby was yours? Well, I've got news for you, Dad. She is. The resemblance to both you and me is unmistakable. Is she who you're trying to find? Is that why you had that article on your desk? Or is there more you're hiding from me? His dad puts a hand to his head, looking pained, and in that moment, Less like the authoritarian control freak Theo was always scared of, and more like an old man. It's complicated. I asked Glenn to look into it for me. He says this as though he's discussing something as anodyne as the weather. What does Glenn actually do? He made out he's a private detective, but that's bullshit, isn't it? Is he just a con man? I don't know what the police said to you earlier, but if you're linked with him, it won't be good for you. That'll be ridiculous. He turns away from Theo to make tea, but something doesn't sit right about all of this. His dad's responses are purposely evasive. What about the evidence? Asks Theo. His dad doesn't say anything, but Theo notices a stiffening of his shoulders, a hesitation as he dunks a teabag. Evidence. He's playing for time, Theo can tell. Yeah, apparently when your henchman accosted Lorna, your own daughter, in the street, he spits this sentence out, hoping his father will hear the disgust in his voice. He said something about Rose burying some evidence. What did he mean? His dad still has his back to Theo. I have no idea, he says. But Theo can hear the lie in his voice. And then Davis broke into the cottage. Nothing was taken. Funny that. But he was obviously looking for something. His dad turns to face him and hands him a mug. I know nothing about that. Of course you do, says Theo, taking the tea. Davis never does anything unless you say so. Is this what you were like with the police? They'll see through it, Dad. You're tied with Glenn now. His dad regards him over the mug. It's one Theo bought him for Father's Day with a golfer on the front mid-swing. Theo detects a flicker of something in his father's eyes. Guilt, perhaps? Remorse? Fear? He's not sure. He's always been so hard to read, so closed. Theo sips his tea. His dad is still intimidating, he realises, as he watches him. But he's a pensioner now. He can no longer hurt Theo. He has no control over Theo's life. Theo is totally self-sufficient. He has never expected anything from his father. The things he did for him, they were born out of a sense of duty and love for his mother. It was always drilled into him as a kid to love and respect his father. But it should work both ways. He felt he should love his dad when he was growing up, so never questioned it. But now, if he's really honest with himself, he has no such feelings for him. He swallows his tea. And those photos of the women you had in your study. They're just women I helped. I like to keep a record, that's all. His father's voice sounds strained. I told you this at the restaurant. Taking photos without their knowledge. It's not a crime. I wasn't hurting anyone. Then why hide them? His dad empties his tea down the drain and almost throws his cup into the sink where it clatters. I've had enough of the third degree. I need to get going. He stalks past Theo. Let yourself out, he calls over his shoulder as he picks up his bag of golf clubs by the door and hoists it over his shoulder. And don't bother sneaking around my study. You won't find anything. What about murder, Dad? He says, following him down the hallway. Is that why you sent Glenn to find the evidence at Rose's cottage? It's on the tip of his tongue to question him about his mother's accident too, but he decides not to. For now. His father stops, his stance rigid. Then he turns slowly to Theo, his expression menacing.